Welcome to Recalculating Small Business. Like its award-winning book, Recalculating is dedicated to small business in America. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money.
Dan Perkins here, your co-host, along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating for Small Business. Our radio program is dedicated to you, helping the small business owners increase their profits. We draw our name from Recalculating, voted the best small business book of 2017 by the Independent Press. In this book, it features ways to grow your small business. Now, here's Don Mazzella.
Dan, Randy Paintner is CEO of Care2, a Silicon Valley startup and progressive petition site that helps nonprofits acquire donors online. Both you and I, Dan, have nonprofits. And I don't know about you, but I'm really anxious to hear how Randy can help nonprofits like ours. Randy, welcome to the program.
Thanks for inviting me. Good to be here.
Randy, tell us a little bit about yourself first, then a little bit about how your company works, and finally your website.
Sure, absolutely. So my name is Randy Painter, and I've been actually working on Care2 for about 20 years now, if you can believe that. My passion is around making the world a better place and engaging individuals with nonprofit organizations. So I'm really devoted the last 20 years to that pursuit. And Care2 is a social network for good. We have over 45 million members. We help people to stand together, start online petitions, and share stories that inspire action. And we use cutting-edge technology, along with our team of really experienced campaigners, who help to fuel the progressive movement by connecting our members with nonprofit organizations they care about. So Care2 is at C-A-R-E and the number 2.com. And we run basically it's Care2, and we have a very large petition site is kind of the core service that we offer there.
But when you say progressive, what do you mean by progressive?
Yeah, well, we define that as kind of all of our members are united around a shared set of values, which is really to create a kinder, more inclusive, and sustainable world. So we work with basically a wide range of nonprofit organizations, about over 2,000 nonprofits, and they're generally center to left of center politically, although you know, we don't consider ourselves a political organization, but some of the campaigns that we work on are probably, you know, are definitely kind of considered political these days. And so we don't work with kind of some of the far right groups, but we work with pretty much, you know, mainstream to left of center organizations, generally large membership-based organizations, anybody from kind of Amnesty International to Sierra Club, Human Rights Watch, you know, a whole variety of topics and nonprofit organizations.
It's interesting. You consider them central, and some of us would consider them leftist. Everything is in the eye of the beholder.
this is true.
But and it's interesting what you would label far right, and I'm going to leave that discussion up to Dan. But exactly how do you work? For instance, I have an organization, the National Robotics Education Foundation, and our goal is to add robotics into the curriculum of schools, kindergarten through high school. Now, would we fit into your pattern?
You might, yeah. So basically, what we do is we work directly with the nonprofit organization to figure out who are the prospective donors that they're looking to attract and what kind of campaigns that we might be able to run to attract those kind of donors. And so we'll actually work directly with the organization to craft that campaign and then reach out to our members. So we have over 45 million members that are part of Care2, and using, you know, we have a lot of data and a lot of analytics to help to understand our membership base. And we will target individuals that are likely to be, you know, quality leads for your organization with that campaign. And so, and we recruit, I mean, generally the campaigns are, we generally recruit 10,000 to, you know, a million or more donor prospects for nonprofits. It really depends on the size of the budget for the organization that we're working with.
Mm-hmm. So do you charge by the funds raised or just by the thousand? How do you charge a nonprofit?
Yeah, so we recruit basically it's a pay for performance basis. So it's a per lead basis, which we will agree to before the campaign starts. We'll agree on an exact price and the number of leads that we'll acquire for them. And so there's no kind of risk involved for the organization that they may, you know, not get the right number, or it may cost them more than that they expect. So it's one of the real big advantages over something like Facebook or something like, often even direct mail or the various other techniques or the channels that nonprofits use. We're really a much more guaranteed solution for them.
Well, where do you get your data from?
Well, it's primarily from the individuals that are signing the petition. So when someone signs a petition, they, for the vast majority of campaigns, it's important to know where they're living. So it's their street address, their name, and their email address. And so then we have other appended data that we will append onto that to help kind of augment our understanding of those individuals. And it turns out that an individual who signs an online petition on behalf of a nonprofit organization is about 7 times more likely to make a donation to that organization versus somebody that goes directly to that organization's website and signs up for their newsletter. So these individuals have, probably because they've expressed kind of a public interest in support of that organization, they tend to be quality donor prospects. And so we will ask them, we'll basically send out this campaign to the individuals. If they want to sign the petition on behalf of the nonprofit, that's great. But the only way that we'll send their contact information to the nonprofit is if they also opt to receive more information from that organization. So it's an entirely permission-based solution here. And that's how nonprofits are getting these kind of really quality leads that they're then kind of establishing rapport with, and trying to get them to take action on their behalf as well as to make donations.
I'm going to turn it over to Dan. I'm sure he has a lot of questions.
Thank you, Randy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yes, sir. Let me ask you a question about something you said in your conversation with Don. You said you do not raise money for far right, but you didn't say you don't raise money for far left.
Correct.
So you do raise money far left?
Well, so just to be clear, we don't raise money directly. We sometimes have promotions for direct donation appeals, but in general, what we're doing is we're building capacity. So we're recruiting donor prospects. We're not actually asking people for money on our site. That said, yes, we absolutely work with kind of left of center organizations. One of the kind of keys to our success is that the individuals that are on our site share kind of these progressive values, basically. There have been other petition platforms out there, petition sites out there that have attempted to kind of cater to both sides, kind of the far left and the far right and everybody in between. And that's never really worked out very well in terms of the quality of the donor prospects that one gets. And so we've decided to focus really on the center to left of center, kind of a progressive perspective.
Okay. So you don't actually solicit funds. You provide data to the organization. In the criteria of center and far left, center left and far left, do you have a vetting process as to whether or not you will take on a client?
Well, yeah, yes. I mean, so we basically look at the campaign that and the types of issues that the organization is standing for and determine kind of internally if we think it's a good fit with our members. You know, ultimately, the reason that clients come back to us year after year after year is that we get them quality leads. And so if there isn't a good match between our members and the organization's goals, then they're not going to convert to donors. And so most of our clients are really looking at these prospects and the kind of the value of the campaigns that they're running on Care2 from an ROI perspective. And so we try to make sure that whomever we work with is going to get a good return. And so that's kind of the primary criteria, I would say, is does this organization appeal to our membership base?
So you do, if you don't think the cause is viable with your constituents, you won't do business with them.
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay. Are you involved in any way, shape, or form with the organizations that sponsored the demonstration of high school students around the country this past weekend?
Yeah. So actually, there were many of our members took part in those rallies, and that's definitely gun control is a big topic on Care2, and we work with a number of the organizations that are out there advocating for more gun control, such as Gabby Giffords and oh my gosh, I'm spacing on the names of them at the moment. And so we've been working with those groups and also individuals who are, so actually I should kind of back up a minute just to say that the way that most people find our site in the first place is that individuals will come and start a petition. So it's an individual who's starting the petition. Often it's about a hyper-local issue. Maybe it's about their school. Maybe it's about a local park. Sometimes it's a global issue. Cecil the lion that was basically shot by kind of pulled out of a park and then killed by a Minnesota dentist was a huge million-plus signature petition that started on Care2. So these petitions are started by individuals. That kind of attracts the people that are coming to sign these petitions. And then we have sponsored petitions. That's where the nonprofit clients come in, where we basically present them a sponsored petition after they've signed usually this first citizen petition. So kind of circling back to the marches, there have been many petitions that were started by either high schoolers or others who are advocating for more gun control. So that's absolutely part of what we do.
Do you work with Black Lives Matter?
There is no kind of central organization that's kind of running that as a nonprofit organization that I know of anyway. There are many organizations that certainly support their many of the parts of that platform, and so we certainly will work with organizations that are supporting equality for all. And so, as part of the overall offering, that's certainly part of what we do, yes.
And just two other quick ones, CARE and Antifa.
CARE, yes. And I'm sorry, the last one was what? They are not not a nonprofit that and not a as far as I know and not one of our clients.
And when I said CARE, I wasn't thinking about the relief packages. I was thinking about the other CARE.
CARE Muslim International is what
I'm sorry.
I'm thinking. So I was thinking of CARE International. Are you referring to something else?
What does that CARE International do?
Support basically international development and international relief efforts, helping people in impoverished countries.
It's not the Muslim CARE unit, which is a radical organization. So that's far left, but that's maybe too far left for you. Have you ever ever had a situation in dealing with especially the far left that an organization takes a direction that you think is not what you would like to have your list solicited?
You know, I think we take our read from our membership base. So it's kind of what we think that they are, what's going to resonate best with them. And I'm trying to think of an organization that might have been, you know, there may have been a time back there was a strong kind of anti-vaccine movement at one point that probably appealed to some of our members. But since then kind of the center of gravity has shifted more back towards the importance of vaccination. But I don't think there was a nonprofit specifically that was trying to promote, you know, any of those agendas on either side, frankly. So I guess the answer is no. I can't think of an example at the moment.
Okay. What about national political parties?
So we work with, you know, organizations like the DCCC, and we've worked with a number of the campaigns. So if they're political candidates that are going to likely appeal to our membership, then absolutely we'll be happy to work with them.
So did you work for Hillary in 2016?
We worked with both Bernie and Hillary. Yeah, actually Bernie was the big winner kind of on our site, I would say. There was a lot of excitement around that. We really, I think, probably were the single best, as far as I know, we're the single best performing source for them in that campaign in terms of helping them to raise money.
Good. So let me, if I could, broaden the perspective just a little bit. We have seen in the last week the discovery of information and the relationship that Facebook and Google had with campaigns under Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, and the extent of which they used data to mine to try and convince people to vote for their candidate. Yet there seems to be some concern today that wasn't a concern when Barack Obama was using that technology. There seems to be some concern on the Democratic side to the extent of which Mr. Trump and his campaign used similar data mining techniques. And not so much that I wanted any information or don't want to talk about your role in the Hillary or Sanders campaign, I'm curious as to what you think about the issue of privacy and of my personal data.
Yeah, no, it's an extremely important issue these days. It's interesting. Kind of having been in this space for as long as I have, I've been always surprised how little discussion there has been about this topic because it is so important. And I think it's key to maintain the trust of individuals who are using various services. And I think in general, you know, we all tend to kind of blindly click the terms of service. I know I agree with the terms of service without actually reading it. And there's all sorts of, you know, opportunities to take advantage of our data within those terms of service and most sites where we blindly click. So I think it's a huge issue. I think, I think part of the challenge, I think, or the part of the reason that it has become such an issue recently is this Cambridge Analytica and what they did with the data, and that from what I understand, it, you know, it certainly sounds like they did something that was against the terms of service and basically violated that. And time will tell kind of what exactly comes of that. But it's a big issue for Facebook because they can't let that happen. That is just it's just wrong. And it's fascinating too that they even ever thought that was a good idea to let people give people access to some of this information, which is, you know, I think Facebook has seen itself as a platform, and they therefore wanted to kind of attract applications that are kind of connected into their system, and therefore they felt like they needed to give away certain data to attract those various services that could create these applications on their platform. I think they learned, they learned back in, I think it was 2014 or so when they changed their policy, that was not a good strategy. And I mean, the data that Facebook owns on all of us it's really their crown jewels. And so it's crazy for them to have even considered to give that up, I believe. And certainly was quite misguided, I think, and that it was taken advantage of. So I think we're going to have some sort of regulation come down on this. But I think it's Facebook probably will be okay with much of that regulation because, frankly, they don't want to give away that data anymore now that they've kind of figured out how important it is to them. And I think it also helps to prevent incumbents from coming in. So it actually may benefit them in the long run to have some of this regulation. So that's my expectation is that it's going to have to get regulated at some point.
So, but from a practical standpoint, as I understand it, the files that Cambridge Analytica was dealing with was about 250,000 to 280,000 files. Yet the Obama administration and the Hillary campaign was able to access information on millions of people. So I'm trying to understand why it was okay for Obama and Hillary, but not okay for Trump.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to the kind of the perspectives on some of the campaigns, some of those issues. But I do think part of what's happening is that there's now a sudden realization about how real this is and how scary it can be when it can influence campaigns. And, I think, frankly, I mean, this is something that political campaigns have been doing since they first kind of came on into existence, is looking for more information on the people that are likely to vote and therefore tailoring their campaigns in a way that's going to appeal to them. And so I think it's been an issue for a very long time. I think it grew particularly loud now because of the concern about fake news and fake stories, and because the Cambridge Analytica seems to have misappropriated that the data and violated agreements. But it's something that I think is going to have to get regulated because it's just not good. It's not good for any of us, believe me.
Let me ask you one more question, then I'll throw it back to Don. Following up on that, in our country, we like to think that most of the good guys follow the rules, but we also understand that the bad guys don't. And it seems to me that the issue here is not Cambridge, but is the security. When we see breaches in the financial service system where hundreds of millions of personal records are co-opted, and whether it's bank files, credit card files, whatever it is, to me, those all become sources of information that foreign governments or bad guys or terrorists can use against us. So I'm concerned that we're focusing perhaps not enough attention of cybersecurity, and we're trying to fix it with people honoring the agreements. Well, bad guys don't honor agreements. And I have a concern that we're not spending enough time looking at hacking technology.
Right. Yeah, it's a big issue, and it's something we spend a lot of time on, is how to protect our data that we have, because it's a real threat out there, and so we take a lot of measures to basically protect that data. And I think I do believe that Facebook is also has gotten a lot smarter about that, and they're obviously a massive target. But cybersecurity is an extremely important topic, and will be kind of forever, I think, going forward. But yeah, it's not. It's got to be more than simply agreements. Absolutely, it's got to be. You got to have strong protection against, you know, foreign governments or you know, competitors or whatever. There's going to be, you know, bad guys out there for sure. But you know, I think sometimes legislation is required. Sometimes it's just simply it's going to be in the competitive best interest of an organization to do the right thing and protect its users to a greater degree. So I think this has been a wake-up call for a lot of organizations. I think you're going to see just a lot more people taking a lot more more measures to protect the user data as they should.
This is Don Mazzella again, Randy, and I've been listening into this discussion, and you and Dan have raised some really important issues. Randy, your website again and what your company does, because we're unfortunately running out of time. I think we could have gone another half hour. But your website and
sure.
How people can reach you?
Yep, it's care2, C-A-R-E, and the number 2.com. And we're a social network for good where people can come start online petitions and sign thousands of different petitions on a whole variety of topics to make the world a better place.
Dan, you want to add anything before Randy leaves?
I thought it was very interesting interview, and thank you so much for answering my questions, and thank you for joining us today.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Marcus Lemonis, J.D. Powers, and John Scully, and 100 other presidents and experts contributed to Recalculating the Book. Why did all these people agree to contribute to the book? I'm Don Mazzella, and I'm the editorial director of Small Business Digest. And for 20 years, we have been offering small business leaders information and data to increase profits. Recalculating the Book was named the best small business book by the Independent Press Association. Whether you need help with marketing, staffing, finance, operations, technology, or many other subjects, they're all here in Recalculating the Book. They're now available at Amazon at a reduced cost. We've also created the radio program Recalculating on recalculating.biz.
Want to know more about health savings accounts for your company or yourself? Go to 2HSA.com and get a free employer's primer. Health savings accounts are a cost-effective way of offering health care benefits to your employees and yourself. HSAs build retirement funds for your employees, improve morale, and reduce your health care benefit cost. For a free employer guide to HSAs, go to 2HSA.com. That's 2HSA.com.
Dan Perkins here from Recalculating.biz with your featured book. I want to tell you about a recent interview I had with Bob Bethel, a turnaround specialist with lots of success in small business. Bob's new book is Strengthen Your Business, Fail-Proof Strategies for Small Business. He tells us of his life successes and failures that have made him and his clients so successful. Over the years, Bob has brought 77 companies back from the brink and changed them into thriving, profitable businesses. His energy is amazing, and at 74, he proves that you can still have a great deal to give others if you just try. His suggestions are easy to understand and very helpful. One insight struck me was that most companies do not have a plan. The old Chinese proverb says, if you don't know where you're going, then any road will take you there, is true today. Bob Bethel's book, Strengthen Your Business, can be found at Amazon.com or can be ordered at your local bookstore. This has been Dan Perkins with your Recalculating.biz featured book.
Welcome back to Recalculating, the program dedicated to American small business. Now it's time to bring together our two experts, Dan Perkins and Don Mazzella, as they discuss things that are happening now that are affecting your business success.
Dan, our next guest is Robert Harrell, who's the head of credit research at Value Penguin. He's here to tell us about changes in the regulations affecting credit cards issued to small businesses and more. Robert, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me.
Well, first, tell us a little bit about yourself, about Value Penguin, and then last of all, what are these changes that that businesses face in coming months?
Well, Value Penguin is a consumer research site. We do our best to help both consumers and small business owners navigate different financial products and the decisions they have to make within them. So if it's something like simple as picking the right credit card to use or something like understanding all these regulations that are going to be affecting how money is lent to you, we try and simplify all that information and explain it to our readers as best we can.
Can you spell out the site for us?
Yeah, that's valuepenguin.com, valuepenguin.com.
When I heard about you and your company, now tell us, what are the changes coming that many small businesses rely on credit cards, both to take them and to use them. So tell us what's going to happen.
Sure thing. So applying for a small business credit card used to be fairly simple. It was no different, really, than applying for a personal card. And most people have kind of know what that experience looks like. You go online or you go into a bank, you submit all the proper information, which is your social security number. If you're a small business, you may need to submit your tax ID number. And that was pretty much it. In terms of paperwork, this was fairly light. However, beginning May 11th of this year, there's going to be a couple of changes to that policy that are going to make it a little bit harder for small business owners who want to open up a small business card. Namely, the beneficial owner information is going to have to be submitted alongside of any application. And what that means is you're going to have to submit identifications and paperwork for anyone who owns at least 25% or more of your company, either directly or indirectly. And you're going to have to submit at least one individual or the information of at least one individual who has any sort of significant responsibility or control over your business. So that may be a vice president, a treasurer, a managing member of the board, people like that. So at most, you're submitting information for an additional five people, as opposed to just, you know, one sole proprietor as it used to be.
And why are they doing this?
So the argument is the sort of body that created this regulation and you know is enacting it, the so-called Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, FinCEN for short, and they're part of the Treasury Department. They're trying to combat money laundering in the United States, and they estimate that something around $300 billion is laundered annually through just different businesses, and they worry that bad actors are able to kind of go under the system and not be discovered by acting as these third parties for businesses. So one person might be, you know, a legitimate business owner, and they may be aiding some people who have less than, you know, stellar less than stellar motives behind their backs. So it's mostly an anti-money laundering initiative.
But what happens to people who've taken it out before? Are they going to be required to bring in their paperwork, or is it going to be all new accounts?
So the good news with this is that it's only going to be affecting new accounts opened after May 11th. If you already have a small business credit card, your bank will not be contacting you to surrender this information. So it's only really going to affect any new business after the date in which this is enacted.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, what you're saying is that if we start a new business and want a credit card, not only do we have to have all the information about the business, but at least one person has to submit personal information. Is that about correct?
That's correct. Yes, And okay. These things can get even more complicated if you start thinking about different sort of ownership structures. So if it's you plus some trust that owns your business, then that gets complicated, and the business might have to figure out, well, exactly how many more people do I have to submit information for? If a trust owns part of my business and has a controlling share of my business, then small business owners may be confused, may need to have some sort of legal advice or hire an attorney or somebody to help guide their paperwork, which is already tremendously more complicated than it used to be. Again, it was fairly simple to get a small business card before this regulation.
Oh yeah, well, that's for sure. They keep sending us. I don't know about them, but I keep getting one a week. This opening one of this business or that business. And, just sign the name and you're off and running. But anyway, Dan, I'd like to come back and talk about some of the better credit cards available. But first, I'm going to turn it over to Dan, and I'm sure he has some questions.
Yes, thank you. Welcome, Robert, to the show. And thank you for talking to us about this important issue.
It's my pleasure.
So let me deep dive into this. Mm-hmm. These quote regulations unquote, mm-hmm. which would be an appropriate way to classify these as regulations.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Okay. These kind of regulations don't originate overnight. Were these regulations mm-hmm. promulgated in the Obama administration?
So I forget the exact date, but yes, I believe this is something that's been in the works since early 2016. So it might have been in sort of So that's for sure.
Okay.
This has been in the works for a while now.
So what has I want to give you a parallel example. Don and I have done a couple of shows about the Department of Labor and their infringement on the Securities and Exchange Commission under the Obama administration, issuing what was called the fiduciary rule. And mm-hmm. they were forcing anybody who was dealing with individuals who were in qualified retirement plans. There were certain sets of disclosure and transactions and all kinds of crazy things that were put in place. And last week, the Federal District Court ruled against the rules, and the Department of Labor indicated in a press release the day after the ruling that they would were going to walk away from that and we're not going to appeal that. So those regulations that caused enormous amount of dislocation and cost and expense in the financial service industry were done away with, but it's really hard to go back. So my question is, do you envision, after these are in place, would you envision suits against this particular rule?
So that will be highly, highly dependent on sort of the outcomes and whether indeed there's big blowback from businesses and especially from banks who this is going to be costing a lot of money. I think the organization itself, FinCEN, is estimating that there's going to be somewhere between $153 to $282 million in extra costs to the private sector. And, it's so far it seems like banks aren't too happy about this rule. They're going to have to hire additional staff. They're going to have to delegate more resources to just handle the underwriting, the extra underwriting that's going to be going into, processing these applications with these new rules. And depending on how business is impacted, that's what I would, put my money on, affecting whether there's going to be some sort of challenge or some sort of judiciary challenge to these rules.
Okay.
So I guess we're going to see, and probably within the next year or two. So it's very hard to give an answer right now.
I understand, but your inclination is at the moment, much like the fiduciary rule, there could be a challenge. Now at the same At the same time, there is legislation working its way through Congress to repeal Dodd-Frank and the restrictions that were put in by the Obama administration between investment banking and commercial banking. And whether that passes or not, I don't know. But I find it ironic that we get these regulations. They're done by bureaucrats. They're not passed by Congress. And then we have to go through the court system to validate or get rid of them because they were unreasonable, unrealistic, and harmful. And you've already talked about over $100 million of cost. And that's probably your best estimate, but probably far from the truth. So, but it would, if I heard you correctly in your discussions with Don, you were talking about types of the way a business is put together. For example, if I had a sole proprietorship, then I don't have other investors. I'm basically the one-man shop. The rules probably wouldn't change for somebody like me. If I had a limited liability company where there was a managing member who was responsible for making all the financial decisions, these rules may not apply to me either. Is that true?
Yeah, well, that's the confusing part of this regulation as I read it. And you know, maybe somebody with a legal background would have better understanding of this. But if I'm, you know, I'm actually in a good prime spot because most small business owners do not have legal training. So they'll be faced with this sort of thing themselves when they apply for a credit card, right? So it's as the language of the regulation is stated, anyone who owns directly or indirectly 25% or more of the equity of a business has to submit this beneficial owner information. So that does get confusing. If you're a sole proprietor, that's fairly simple. If you're the only, you know, managing entity of the business, then nothing really changes for you. But the moment you have larger businesses of several people owning and managing its funds, that's where things get complicated. And that's where small business owners may be forced to shell out money for some sort of legal advice as to what exactly they're obligated to provide when they're applying for a card.
But let me just take what you just said there, and let me suggest. I don't want to oversimplify, but a simple alternative. Mm-hmm. When I worked on Wall Street for big firms, I did a lot of traveling and I had expenses, but I didn't have a corporate card. I had my own card and the company reimbursed me when I submitted the invoices of expenses paid. So isn't one possibility, it's just the elimination of the corporate card?
Oh, certainly. It's something that business owners do a lot of the time. They'll just, you know, instead of opening an official small business card, they'll just open a personal account, a personal card, and then simply expense everything, come tax time that they charge your personal card. And that's certainly one way of going about it. There's some downsides to this kind of approach. Mainly, one of the benefits you get by opening a small business credit card in your business's name is that you get to build your business's credit. And you know, in the future, if you ever want to apply for another type of loan, say from a financial institution, a bank, what have you, then that kind of works in your favor. And so you really want to start building up that portfolio and that credit history for your business. And if you're going to go the route of just having a personal card, that's not going to be as available.
But in many cases, and Don and I can both attest to this, if you're a small business and you want to borrow money from the bank, they want a personal guarantee from you.
They do, certainly,
They're going to take your personal data anyway. So, I mean, it doesn't seem to be, if I'm giving you the personal data for a loan, I can give you the personal data for a credit card. Anyway, let me move on. I have to tell you, I've never heard of Value Penguin. So tell our listeners, small business people, what is Value Penguin and what other products or services do they offer to small business?
Sure. So Value Penguin is all about providing financial education to both consumers and small business owners. Our website has free resources, so anyone can go on and just browse to our site. Nothing is behind any sort of paywall. Everything is out there for free. And we provide guides and recommendations to everyone and all of our readers on how they should be thinking about when they're shopping for different financial products, be it a credit card or small business insurance, what have you.
So how do you make money?
So we do have relationships with some of the financial products we write about. There's sort of a wall between our editorial and our business side of the company, so that all the recommendations, all the research that we present is always backed by data and kind of independent of any sort of financial relationships we do have with some of these companies. But we do make money on commissions whenever somebody applies through our site for one of the products that we talk about.
Don, back to you.
What I want to ask you, Robert, is if I'm a small business owner, what in your research are the two or three best cards or types of cards that you should consider using for your business? Because I think I once saw a survey where 61% of small businesses under 20 employees use credit cards for more than 50% of their purchases. But anyway, if someone came to you, what card would you recommend?
Sure. So I always urge business owners whenever I get this question to know that there is no one-size-fits-all solution, and the best small business credit card for them is always going to be dependent on what kinds of expenses they have. If you don't want to think about it and you just want one credit card to charge all of your business expenses to, then I'd recommend something like the Capital One Spark Cash Card. It gives 2% cash back on all transactions. That's fairly good. But if you want to really maximize your savings, there's all sorts of credit cards that kind of cater to different types of business expenses. So the Inc. Business Cash from Chase is fairly good at more traditional office-like expenditures. The Inc. Business Preferred is great if you're somebody who travels a lot for business or has to take out clients frequently out to dinner or lunch. So it can really be catered to how you spend. But those three cards kind of encompass a pretty wide net of business needs. So I would say the Spark Cash from Capital One, the Inc. Business Cash, and the Inc. Business Preferred are the top three right now, I'd say.
What about the interest rates? Do you expect them to go up as the Fed increases its prime rate?
Oh, yeah, certainly. So the thing about credit cards is the interest rates on credit cards are directly tied to the federal funds rate. And, you know, so we work closely, like I said, with financial institutions, and the Fed raised rates just last week, and we're already getting notifications from our partners saying, hey, because the rates went up, we're forced to increase rates on all these products. So it's already something that's almost immediately happening, and we expect it to happen several more times. I think the latest forecasts say that there's going to be at least two more hikes throughout 2018.
And what is the what is a good rate for there is no good rate for holding a balance with a credit card, but what is some of the lower cards you've seen with the lowest rates in recent months?
Sure. So yeah, like you said, there is no good rate, and generally I want everyone to never carry a balance on their credit card because it's a pretty bad deal. But of course, the reality is that some people will be forced to, some business owners will have to. So generally, if you can qualify for a rate that's below 13%, an APR below 13 to 14%, that's generally good. And I would say that's a fairly low APR. Of course, credit cards give ranges of APR. So if I'm applying for something like that Inc. Business Preferred card, they may say your APR is going to be between 13 and 20%, and that's, at that point it's kind of hard to guess what your APR will be. They'll only tell you once they run your credit, once they determine what your credit worthiness is. And if you manage to qualify for a rate below 13%, I would say that's pretty good. You can also get cards. There's cards out there, especially for small business owners too, that can provide 0% APR for some promotional length of time. So I believe the Inc. Cash currently gives 0% APR for 12 months. So that's a fairly good deal too, especially if you're a small business owner who's about to have a lot of expenses coming up in the next year, and you know you want to just preemptively get a card that won't charge you interest for that time. So that's a good way of planning around that.
Dan, do you have any more questions?
Yes, I do. I do. Mm-hmm. Many, many years ago, I was involved in the credit card industry and watched the transition from fixed rate cards to variable rate cards. Are there any fixed rate cards left?
Yeah, this is a question I recently got to. I do not see many. The ones I do see are usually offered by credit unions, and just so they're hyper local to specific geographies. Out of the top 10 banks by loan amount, there's not really any fixed rate cards available.
And one last question, if I might, Don. There was a lot of press recently about the fact that the credit card balances are at all-time highs, and that may be concerning a lot of people about credit expansion has gone too far too fast. Do you have any concerns about this explosion of credit card debt?
Oh, yeah, certainly. This is something I've written about, and I could talk for an hour about this topic itself. So it's interesting currently, rates on credit cards are increasing, and the Federal Reserve is increasing its federal funds rate, with the justification that the economy as a whole is doing well, and it can take the increased interest rates on debts. However, if you start looking at things a little bit more closely, specifically looking at credit card users and how they're behaving and how much debt they're taking on, things do seem a little bit alarming, at least to me. There's certain signs that I'm getting as I'm looking through the data that people are having more and more difficulty handling the debt that they have. There was research recently by, it was the Financial Times, right, where overdue payments on credit card debt hit a 7-year high recently. So there's about $11.9 billion of credit card debt that consumers are at least 3 months behind on in terms of repayments. So that's a 7-year high. To me, that's insane that we're facing these kinds of conditions right now. Delinquencies, credit card delinquencies are up as well among some of the bigger issuers too, but especially among smaller banks. And small banks are the ones that tend to lend to consumers who are subprime, who tend to have worse credit scores. And we're beginning to see cracks in those levels, and delinquencies are rising.
Just let me raise one issue. Mm-hmm. You just talked about $11 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, as I understand it, the outstandings of credit card balances is in the trillions.
It is, yeah.
So $11 billion is almost indistinguishable. I'm not poo-pooing $11 billion as a lot of money. But as a percentage of the total credit card base, it's a fraction. 1%.
Sure, but that I would counter with saying that $11.9 billion that I talked about is the what people are 3 months or more behind. So being 3 months or more behind on your credit card payment, that's a fairly extreme scenario, right? And it's already people are far gone with their credit card debt, and they're likely going to lead to charge-offs. If we were to look at, and I would love to look up statistics on people who are just maybe 1 month or 2 months behind, those numbers might look far, far more significant.
Yeah.
I think the reason we highlight the $11.9 billion is because these are people who are in extreme credit card debt and who are unlikely to repay their balances.
Right, right. Don, back to you.
Robert, we could go on and on. It's been a fascinating time. Your website again and how people can reach you? We've been talking with Robert Harrell.
So our website is Value Penguin, Value, V-A-L-U-E, and Penguin like the animal, P-E-N-G-U-I-N.com, ValuePenguin.com.
I got to ask you, where did you come up with that name?
We get it very frequently. So our founders, two of our founders, their last names are Penn and Quinn. And together, when you put those together, that kind of sounds like Penguin, Penquin, Penguin. That's where the name comes from.
Okay. Well, we've been talking with Robert Harrell of Value Penguin. He's been talking about the changes coming in corporate credit cards, and we really thank him so much for being with us. A link to his website will be on our website tonight on recalculating.biz, where you can hear all of our programs. Thank you, Robert, for being with us.
Tell me, Dan, tell me about your latest book.
My current book that's coming out, I should say, is Why Can't Grammy Remember Me? And it's really the first book written for children between the ages of 9 and 12 and their families dealing with dementia. Dementia is a growing problem with the elderly in the United States and around the world. And we are not very well informed about what's going on, what's happening. So I wrote this book in the form of a mystery. And I have two little girls, 9 and 12, who have a magical power to be able to seem to be able to find things that are lost. And so they go to their dads and moms and they say, you know, we work all over the neighborhood helping people find things, and we seem to find things. And their dad says, yes, you have a magical talent to do that. And they said, we'd like to start a business to see if we can help other people. So they decided to start a business. The two girls' name are Hudson and Charlotte. And they start H&C's Lost and Found. If you've lost it, we find it. And so they build a business, and they convince the dads to build them an office and a treehouse in the backyard. And they get busy making posters and flyers trying to get customers. And their dads take them downtown, and they put them in the windows and on the telephone poles and light poles. And they go home, and first week goes by, and nobody comes. And the second week and third week, and nobody comes. They're really, really dejected. And the fourth week comes, and there's a knock at the door. And they walk over and open the door, and there's a young man standing there with one of their flyers in his hands. And he says to them, my dad says the reason why my Grammy can't remember me is because she's lost her memory. And your flyer says you find things that are lost. Can you find my Grammy's memory? Well, they don't know anything about memory. So they take his name and they go see their dads to see what can happen. And the story evolves into how they learn about what dementia is and what's going on in the body when somebody has dementia. And then they decide, while they can't find their customer's memory, they can help him build the tools to retain her in his memory. And so at the end of the book, there are about 10 to 12, 13 things that families can do together to work on to preserve the memory of grandma and grandpa so the generations can know who these people were. And that's the story.
What a great book. When will it be available, and how can people get it?
Well, it'll be available on Amazon.com. A lot of people who have read it, who've had moms and dads that have been stricken with Alzheimer's and dementia, tell me that they really now begin to understand what's happening in grandma's brain. And we took a different approach. Rather than do the typical brain cross-section, I work with the artist, and we design highways in the brain. And there's a brain of one of the little girls and the brain of Grammy. They both have highways, roads. But where the girl's brain, everything is green and go. Grammy's brain is full of no left turns, do not enter, stop, no right turns. So all of the messages that need to come from our brain get screwed up, and we can't function. Great illustrations, though. Wonderful illustrations.
Well, say goodbye, Dan.
All right.
Time for us to go.
Thank you for joining us. And by the way, if you didn't hear all of today's show, you can go to recalculating.biz. And you can pick up this show and past shows to expand your knowledge as becoming more successful entrepreneurs. Thank you for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.
Well, Dan, we've had an interesting day.
Some interesting guests and lots of things for our business partners, the entrepreneurs of America who are listening to our show, can take and put into productive use. So that's all we've got for today. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's episode was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, to contact us, to listen to past shows, and see special offers. Until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success. Recalculating, a program designed to help you be successful.